Hello, fellow Rebel Capitalists. Hope you're well. Wanted to go over a statement from Michael Burry, where he was comparing 2008 to what we're seeing in the markets today with 2020-22, and pointing out that there are a lot of similarities and that same feeling he had in 2008 that he is well known for in the movie The Great Short. He has those same feelings today, and he sees the same result happening in either 2022 or potentially 2023, meaning GFC 2.0. So I wanted to go through his statement and then go over a couple things that are economic metrics that are similar to what we saw prior to the last crash. So let's get into his statement first and foremost. Big Short investor Michael Burry compares the market slump to a plane crash, and hints tumbling stocks and home sales remind him of the housing bubble bursting. So Burry, I guess, also warned asset prices would crumble. He said he doesn't take pleasure in being right. So they're basically going off a couple of tweets that he deleted. It's for some reason he deletes all of his tweets. I'm not sure why, but there's a couple of accounts that take snapshots of them. And a recent one is where they're kind of getting the basis for this article. He said, as I said about 2008, it's like watching a plane crash. He said, it hurts me. It's not fun. And I'm not smiling. Burry told New York Magazine in 2015 that as the housing market crumbled in 2007, he had a recurring nightmare about the disaster in the form of an airplane crashing. Wow. Well, I guess if you want to compare the stock market or the housing market to an airplane crash, I guess it in a lot of ways is similar. I knew what was happening, but there was nothing I or anyone else could do to stop it, he told the publication. Burry added that in the last days of 2007, he was so upset by the catastrophe, he couldn't leave his office, didn't want to go home to see his family. So they're trying to figure out how he's playing this next crash that he is predicting. And I guess he went short Tesla. I'm not sure at what price. He did it in 2021. As we know, Tesla has come down substantially in the last month or so. So who knows if he still has that position. But another thing that he has made public, or that this Market Insider article had access to, was the fact that he is very short Apple. And he's, maybe it was on a different, looks like it was a different story that I was reading. But basically, he's short Apple through buying put options on the stock. So this is a leveraged short position, basically. So if the Apple share price gets down to a certain level, his options are in the money and he can sell them at a huge profit. That was pretty much the most interesting thing I saw within his positions, the Tesla short that who knows if he still has, and the Apple short that he definitely still has on through expressing that bet via the options market and buying puts. He also said in a tweet that fads today like Bitcoin, EV, SaaS, and meme stocks are software as a service, I believe. Meme stocks are like housing in 2007. I mean, we saw it with March of 2021. I mean, there was a lot to that. He's just talking about panic and hysteria, the same things that Jim Rogers has been talking about for years and years and years. Just pay attention to not only when things are cheap, when they're expensive, but also when there is panic and when there is hysteria. When there's panic, you buy. When there is hysteria, you sell, or definitely don't add to your position. And obviously, back in 2021, there was some serious hysteria around these names that he has mentioned, whether it was cryptocurrency, EV, software as a service, or these meme stocks. So now let's go into some of the things he didn't mention, but a lot of the similarities, not just from a standpoint of how he feels and the dreams he's having, but more so on the economic metrics and data. First and foremost, we've got to acknowledge the inversion of the yield curve. So going back to 1980, and you could take this all the way back to 1950, when we had this chart of the twos and the tens, pretty much every time we get an inversion in the yield curve, we get a recession. It's just a matter of when. So obviously in the late 70s, going to 1980, 81, we had this. Prior to the recession, we had in the early 90s, an inversion in, looks like, 89. And then you see it usually steepens out, maybe goes back down, and then we have a recession. It doesn't happen immediately. Same thing, dot-com bust in 2000. We had an inversion, then we had a recession in 2001. And then right here, we get an inversion, a little bit of a steepener inversion again, and then we get the GFC. During the Cerveza sickness, we had another inversion, and of course, we had an inversion in March of 2022. So that would definitely be a similarity between 2008 and what we see, or what he is predicting we'll see maybe this year or at the beginning of 2023. So next thing, as far as similarities, we are in a, or supposedly what the Fed would like us to believe, we are in a rate hiking cycle. I hate to use that terminology, seeing as how we're at 75 basis points. But with an economy that is this dependent upon asset prices for its overall purchasing power, and in an economy where the debt is so high, the sovereign level, the corporate level, and the consumer level, even 75 basis points, going from zero to 75, is a big deal. And I think the Fed just talking about raising rates or becoming a little more hawkish, the market comes down. Today, we saw the Fed minutes come out that many perceived to be a little bit more dovish, signaling that they, or I don't even know if signaling is the right word, probably insinuating, if you're reading between the lines with the Fed minutes, you could come to the conclusion that they'll most likely only raise rates another 150 basis points and then start coming back again, or at least holding off on any more rate hikes. And I guess that the market is, seeing this as dovish. I disagree, because I don't think the Fed can even take rates that high without breaking something significant, which would make them reverse course. I guess the market was under the impression that because the economy is so quote unquote hot, because the unemployment rate is so low, the Fed could take rates up to 4, 5, 6%. Who knows? They could take rates even higher than the CPI. They could take them up to 8.5%. And that somehow would put us into a recession, but it wouldn't be complete and utter devastation. And I don't know where they're coming to that conclusion. I think that's craziness. When you think about, I mean, just let's look at it in an extreme. I mean, what would happen if they take rates? Again, why are they at 75 basis points? If the economy is that hot and it can handle, it can withstand rates of 4, 5, 6% as far as Fed funds, why are we at 75? Why are we not at 2? Why are we not at 3 already? What's stopping the Fed? And obviously what's stopping them is they know damn well that they cannot take rates beyond 2, 3% without creating a 1930s 2.0. Talking about not just the Great Recession or the GFC, I'm talking about the Great Depression. And who knows, it could be an inflationary depression, stagflationary, disinflationary. But it would just completely destroy markets. And in my opinion, the economy is pretty much now just a derivative of the stock market. It's just completely dependent, the real economy, on the purchasing power that Americans have in aggregate total as a result of asset bubbles. So if you get rid of the asset bubbles, you get rid of the economy. And again, I guess the disconnect here, or the difference that I would have with the market, is they actually believed the economy was strong enough to withstand normalized interest rates. Therefore, when the Fed signals that they might only raise rates another 150 basis points, they perceive that to be dovish, or they interpret that to be dovish, where I still interpret that as maybe not hawkish, but disastrous for markets in the economy. I don't think they can even take them that high. I think they can talk about taking them that high. And that's the game I think they're playing. Let's just talk tough and hope that asset prices come down to a level where it starts impacting the CPI. So it's at least politically palatable. So CPI at least starts trending down significantly. And then we'll just cross that bridge when we get there. But I think they're all bark and no bite. I've said this quite a few times on recent videos, where they're talking like they could take rates to 4 or 5%, like they could normalize. But there's just no chance of that. I shouldn't say there's no, there's just almost a zero, there's such a low probability of that without it breaking something to the degree to which they would have to reverse course that I don't even think it's worth giving much thought to. So let's keep moving on here. And another thing I want to point out, that look at this trend. Every single time they go through a rate hiking cycle, they raise rates to a lower level before something breaks. Now, the exception here is 1985. So this isn't kind of a steadfast rule like the inversion of the curve, but it's still, there's a lot of correlation. So in 1981, they could raise rates to 19% before they got this part of the recession. But in the 1990s or late 80s, they could only raise rates to 9.8%, which again sounds like an astronomical number compared to what we have today. But then you move forward to the next recession, they could only get rates up to 6.5%. Next recession, only 5.2. The next recession, only 2.4. This is another reason why I don't think, if they're talking about another 150 basis points, that would put us at 2.25. And that would be the same level pretty much that we were at in March of 2019. But the debt is way higher now. The debt's plural. The economy is way more dependent upon these asset prices that are dependent upon low interest rates, even more so than we were in 2019. And this is just more fuel for the fire when it comes to my view, my base case, that they can talk tough all they want, but they could never, ever, ever take rates or normalize rates. And therefore, if they're just saying that they can take rates up another 150 basis points, that isn't a surprise to me, like it's surprising the market. So we went over the inversion, and we've another thing that's consistent with or similar to today and pretty much most recessions we've gone into is it happens as a result of the Fed going into a rate hiking cycle, regardless of how fast they have to reverse course. And as you can, and like we noted, going back to 1980, they've had to reverse course faster and faster and faster, or in other words, at a lower and lower interest rate. Now we go over to repo. And most of you guys know from listening to Snyder or watching my videos, there was a big issue with repo prior to 2009 or prior to the GFC. That's what the GFC was really all about. It was about repo. It was about just a lack of liquidity. And the collateral that was pristine all of a sudden overnight was not pristine. And that led to bankruptcies like Lehman because they couldn't access the dollar liquidity they needed. They couldn't access the repo market. The repo market broke, if you want to look at it that way. So how is that similar to what we see today? Well, there's a lot of repo fails, and Snyder's been talking about that. I think that's consistent with what we saw prior or during the GFC. But another thing is just what the money market funds are telling us through their actions. They're not verbally telling us what they're doing, but through their actions, we can see that there could be some anxiety around the banking system. There could be some perceived risk, additional perceived risk that these large pools of money see that CNBC isn't telling us about. Why do I say that? Look at what reverse repo, or excuse me, this is the, no, I'm sorry, wrong chart right here. Here's reverse repo. So reverse repo, where the Fed is a counterparty, is simply where these money market funds want to park their cash at the Fed instead of at a commercial bank. So why would they want to do that? Well, maybe they could make a better return. You say maybe they want the treasuries because pretty much 100% of these transactions, the collateral being used is a treasury. So they would give their cash to the Fed, and the Fed as collateral would give them a treasury. But from what I understand, these money market funds cannot lend out the treasuries they have as collateral. They cannot rehypothecate the treasuries they receive from the Federal Reserve. So you kind of say, that's probably not it. It's not like they're hedge funds that want to use these treasuries, or primary dealers that want to use these treasuries to rehypothecate and get a much higher return than they are paying out to the people that are funding their account to begin with. Meaning they're paying the people that have the money that are parking it with the money market fund, the customers, let's say, the investors, they're paying them 1%, right? And let's say they can park the cash at the Fed and get 0.5%. Say, okay, well, they're still losing money. No, they're not, because then they could take those treasuries, they could rehypothecate them, they could get a 2 or 3% return on the money. Now, all of a sudden, there's a big profit there. The difference between what they're paying for the money, which is 1% in this example, and the 3 or 4% that they're making by rehypothecating that treasury, in addition to the, call it 0.5% that they're getting paid from the Fed in this reverse repo transaction. Because in a reverse repo, when the Fed is the counterparty, the money market fund is actually lending the Fed money. That's how it works. So the Fed is going to pay them a little bit less than IOR, which is interest on reserves. This is the money that they're paying, the interest rate they're paying banks for bank reserves held at the Fed. So I don't want to go off on a tangent there like I just did. The bottom line here is the money market funds most likely aren't executing this transaction just to get the treasuries so they can rehypothecate. So why are they doing it? The only other conclusion that I could come to, you know, a lot of people say, oh, well, they just got so much money that they're just parking it at the Fed. Well, that doesn't really make sense. I mean, if you have $2 billion as opposed to $1 billion, does that somehow reach a capacity limit for the bank? Not really. Why wouldn't the bank want a deposit of $2 billion instead of $1 billion? That doesn't make a lot of sense. Now, there is an argument, I think, that Joseph Wang makes very, very well, that this is money that the banks really don't like because it's very volatile. It's kind of hot money. It could come in and out and in and out. And banks much prefer to have money that's going to be there longer term. That's why they'd prefer that you set up a savings account compared to a checking account, or one of the reasons. But I don't know. That could be it. But I also think it could be the money market funds themselves would rather park their cash at the Fed because they see additional counterparty risk with the commercial banks where they held their money, let's say right during this time period. Look at January 2021. There was $7 billion in these reverse repos. Today, and by the way, that's a daily transaction amount. Today, there's over $2 trillion daily being parked at the Fed's reverse repo facility. Or I guess they call it a standing reverse repo facility, I believe. And so this to me is saying the banks see this additional counterparty risk. And why I mean additional, above and beyond what they're willing to accept. And therefore, they're saying we would rather park our cash at the Fed. And the more quote unquote money that you see being parked at the Fed, the more perceived counterparty risk is in the banking system with these money market funds. This is my base case. I'm not saying that this is absolutely unequivocally the way it's working, but this is what makes the most sense to me. So again, it's similar to 2008 from the standpoint of the blow up we saw in the repo market, failure we saw in the repo market then was a result of the same thing, perceived counterparty risk. The banks or the people with the cash weren't willing to lend it to Lehman Brothers because their collateral wasn't good enough based on the perceived counterparty risk. And you could have seen that with the repo fails back then. And I think you could be seeing that with the reverse repos spiking to all-time highs, over $2 trillion a day with the Fed as a counterparty today in 2022. All right, guys, enjoy the rest of your afternoon. As always, make sure that you're standing up for freedom, liberty, free market capitalism. We'll see you on the next video. 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 We'll see you on the next video.